This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. While repeated scientific studies find no connection between autism and vaccines, many people don't believe it. Thousands of families say their children developed autism shortly after they received common childhood vaccines, and many blame thimerosal, a mercury-containing preservative found in some vaccines. On Monday, a federal vaccine court here in Washington started to hear testimony in a trial that's expected to last for weeks. A finding for the families could make many parents think twice about vaccinating their children, and doctors worry that could leave kids more vulnerable to sometimes serious childhood diseases without changing the rates of autism. Later in the program, R.E.S.P.E.C.T., Aretha Franklin's great hit, turns 40. We'll hear what that song has meant and talk with one of the musicians who played on the record. But first, questions and answers about vaccines and autism. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And we begin with Gardner Harris, a science reporter for The New York Times, who's been writing about the trial in federal vaccine court. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be here, Neil.
And we're going to put listeners' questions to specialists on autism and on vaccines in a few minutes. But let me begin by asking you, there's a federal vaccine court?
It is. It's part of the Federal Court of Claims. It was a system set up 20 years ago mostly to protect vaccine makers from a growing spate of lawsuits about vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
It's a liability protection system, basically. And if you have, if you feel that your child has been injured by vaccines, you must go to the federal vaccine court. And actually, it's a system that's worked rather well.
Mm-hmm.
It's funded by a tax on all vaccines. And particularly last year when there was all this worry about pandemic flu, the government is now spending hundreds of millions of dollars trying to encourage more companies to become vaccine makers. And frankly, if not for the federal vaccine court, that effort would have been much, much harder.
Are there special vaccine judges?
There are. Special masters, they're called. And they are part of this entire system of essentially federal claims courts, where you go. It's a piece of the federal judiciary where you go make claims against the government, basically.
And they are specialists in vaccinations? They're doctors?
In these issues, they are not doctors, but they certainly have become accustomed to these claims, although this particular autism claim is overwhelming the system and is a unique situation for them and for everyone.
Now, this is 5,000 families.
4,800, but yeah, roughly nearly 5,000.
And these claims go back some years. How come it's taken so long to get to court?
Well, it depends on who you talk to there. I think fairly say that the claimants themselves have delayed the proceeding for many years in hopes of coming up with better proof that their claims are true. They've also tried to separate themselves as much as they can from a 2004 Institute of Medicine report that obviously concluded that there is no connection between vaccinations and autism. And I think the claimants hope that the more time that passes between their case appearing in court and the IOM report, the more they might be able to argue to the special masters that they've got new information that the IOM didn't see, that they have a better case, basically.
And as the trial got underway, what did are there lawyers for each of these sets of parents? Is this a class action? What's going on?
So there are 4,800 cases, but the court is doing this in sort of a test case mode. So there are three initial cases. The first one being this 12-year-old girl, Michelle Cedillo. There's going to be two other test cases, actually on a relatively narrow part of these autism arguments, one that actually has to do less with thimerosal and more with the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, rubella.
Mm-hmm.
And then perhaps later, in early 2008 or later in 2008, they will do more test cases that simply focus on thimerosal. Mm-hmm.
And as they go through this, what's the burden of proof? Is this beyond a reasonable doubt?
It's not quite that high. It's the same. It's basically the standard burden of proof that is in all civil court cases.
Preponderance of the evidence.
Right, exactly. And the lawyers on the claimant side sort of made a lot of the idea that the burden of proof is lower than in criminal courts, but that's true in any civil proceeding.
And it's obviously not a jury trial. The special masters who hear the case will decide it.
Right, but it's a little bizarre that way because the lawyers for the claimants... So normally when you go into a court where a judge is making the decision, and this is true in all federal appeals courts, it's true in federal claims courts, all that, there is a podium right in front of the judges. The lawyers go before the podium and speak directly to the judges. In this case, the claimant's attorney turned the podium around and spoke to the audience instead of to the special masters who will actually make the decision. And I think it tells a lot about this case. It's not clear that this case is all just sort of about money or even about winning for the claimants. I think for the claimants, they're talking to a different audience. There has been a lot of effort on Capitol Hill, for instance, to help out these sorts of these particular claimants. So I think this whole effort in court is part of a larger process that these claimants are looking for. Both, I think, money they would love to win, I'm sure. But more than that, I think that they want some sort of recognition more broadly, not only that perhaps their ideas about problems with vaccines being right, but more than that, when you talk to them, they just want to tell you just how hard their lives are. And I think that their lives really are hard.
Does that suggest that should they, in the event that they're not successful, that the court finds that indeed there is no connection, as so many scientific studies have, between autism and vaccines, that their case will not end there?
I think that's right. First of all, there's a number of these claimants. There's a process by which if after a certain period of time in federal vaccine court, you still do not have a decision, you then can go into U.S. District Court. And there are a number of claimants who are doing that, not very successfully. Some are doing it in state courts. Some are doing it in federal district court. But I think the politics of this thing continues. It is a very curious situation, and I have never really seen this on a widespread basis as a science reporter. You have an extraordinary collection, an extraordinary community, really, of parents who believe something fervently that nearly all available science says is not true. Now, I think that there, I'm just speculating here. I think that there are a couple of reasons for this. First, as I think your experts will show, if they don't believe that vaccines did this, where do they go? Who knows what causes autism? It is a terrible and mysterious disease. And this group of experts sort of alleged experts on vaccines who are telling them that they caused this, then offer them hope to cure it. And it's a wonderful siren song that is, I think, the reason why they have persisted so long in this belief, despite study after study after study showing that it's not true.
Gardner Harris, thanks very much. We appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Gardner Harris, a science reporter for The New York Times, with us here today in Studio 3A talking about the trial in federal vaccine court. Now let us introduce our two experts who are here to answer your questions about vaccines and autism. David Amaral is a professor of medical psychiatry with the University of California, Davis, the MIND Institute. He's with us today from KXJZ in Sacramento, California. Nice to have you on the program today.
Hi, Neil.
And also with me here in Studio 3A in Washington is Dr. Peter Hotez, president of the Sabin Vaccine Institute. Nice of you to come in as well.
Thanks for having me.
And let's see if we can get some listeners' calls on the line. Let's go first to Julia. Julia is with us from New Jersey.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. I have a question. I have an autistic son, and I spend almost all my time doing research trying to improve him. And I'm kind of curious because I have looked at vaccination rates, and I have noticed that among groups of people who do not vaccinate, such as the Amish, and there are several hundred thousand Amish in the Northeast, their rates are extraordinarily low. And I know this question was put to Dr. Julie Gephardt of the CDC, and her answer was that, well, they probably have different genetics, which I'm not buying because they seem to get heart disease, cancer, diabetes, everything else that we get. So I was wondering if anybody can, you know, kind of clue me in on this.
David Amaral, you're the autism expert.
Well, I think, Neil, it's a good question and one that really needs further evaluation and research. There have been something on the order of 11 epidemiological studies now looking at the MMR vaccine and autism.
MMR, that's measles, mumps, and rubella?
That's correct, okay. Yes. And by and large, the evidence has shown that children that receive those vaccines are not more likely to have autism than those who do not. But again,
I'm not talking about just one jab. I'm talking about a cumulative effect. I mean, the rate of vaccines has that given to kids between the ages of 0 and 2 years old has tripled in the past decade. And the rates of autism seem to parallel those rates. And that's a very important question, as well as the fact that the people who do not vaccinate have much lower rates of autism.
And let's see if we can turn to Dr. Hotez for an answer to that.
Oh, thank you. First of all, I'd like to mention that in addition to being a vaccine researcher, I'm also the parent of an autistic child. So it's somewhat of a unique perspective on both sides. So I think Mr. Harris's comments on the difficulty and the desperation of parents who have autistic kids, I think that's absolutely right on, that you're so desperate to try to identify what's causing this, which wreaks havoc with so many families, that you just grasp onto anything. And that's what's really happened. People have grasped onto vaccines, even though we have 5 excellent epidemiologic studies showing no link.
All right. Dr. Hotez, stay with us. We'll get to Julia's question when we come back from a short break. Julia, I'm going to put you on hold for a second. Is that all right?
Sure.
Okay. And our other guest, of course, with us is David Amaral, who's with us from KXJZ in Sacramento. More questions and answers about autism when we come back. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about autism and vaccines. We just heard about the federal vaccine court here in Washington hearing arguments about whether childhood vaccines can be connected to autism. If it decides for the plaintiffs, doctors worry it could make parents think twice about vaccinating their kids and lead to more sick children with no drop in the rates of autism. As we mentioned earlier, a large number of scientific studies have found no connection between vaccines and autism. Today, questions and answers. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. You can also share your stories at our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. I have to apologize to our caller, Julia. I meant to put her on hold. I hit the wrong button and hung up by mistake. But Dr. Peter Hotez, who's with us here in Studio 3A, president of the Sabin Vaccine Institute, she raised the question about there's so much of a coincidence between the increase in vaccines and an increase in autism.
Well, I think it's very important to look at that increase in autism and that it's not a true increase, that there's an increase in autism diagnoses, and that's because kids who were previously labeled as being mentally retarded, kids who are being labeled as schizophrenic, kids who would not even have any neuropsychiatric diagnosis, but they might have been considered somewhat odd kids. None of these children were ever diagnosed as was thought of as having autistic spectrum disorder. And it's as we've enlarged this category, talk about a disorder that includes pervasive developmental disorder. Pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, includes Rett syndrome, includes Asperger syndrome. This is all something that's happened post 1990. So it's only now that school teachers are really starting to throw these kids with this label of autistic spectrum disorder. So there is no epidemic of autism. I think that's very important.
And let me put a similar question to David Amaral, a professor of medical psychiatry at the University of California, Davis, the MIND Institute there. This from Ken in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Wasn't the definition of autism changed about 10 years ago, and isn't that why the rates of autism have gone up?
Well, I think it's a complex issue, and I would agree that the definition, certainly the change in the definition has led to the increase, to a certain portion of the increase in autism. But I think there's a consensus in the autism field that if you take all of those diagnostic differences and artifacts of the system, that nonetheless there has been a real increase in autism. Autism now affects 1 in 150 children in the United States. And I think it's a perplexing disorder. It's a complex, behaviorally defined, but medical disorder. And I think the field also thinks that there's probably going to be multiple types of autism and multiple causes. I don't think we actually have the scientific evidence at the moment to rule out the magnitude or rule out the fact that autism has increased, as Dr. Hotez has said. But we don't also have the scientific evidence to understand what magnitude of increase there's been. Mm-hmm. But as many of the parents that I work with say, if it was really 1 in 150 people with autism over the last 30 or 40 years, where are the 50-year-old individuals with autism? It looks to us like there has been a real increase in autism.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Sally. Sally's with us from San Antonio in Texas.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm the mother of a wonderful 3-year-old with autism, and I was kind of curious. As I understand, in 2003, they eliminated Thimerosal from all the vaccines except for the flu. Is that correct?
Is that correct, Dr. Hotez?
In the United States. That's right.
So is there any study regarding how much mercury or anything like that may have triggered this, or is there any way that we can be a part of this lawsuit based on just having a flu shot?
Thimerosal is mercury is a part of thimerosal. I'm not sure which of you is a better place to answer that. Dr. Hotez?
I'm not sure of the question. The question is how much mercury is in the flu vaccine?
No, not so much as how much is in the flu vaccine, but is it a quantity based, or is it just having any mercury introduced that they're basing their case upon?
I can't speak about the law case, the legal proceedings. I don't know. I mean, one of the things that always strikes me as quite interesting is we know that organic mercury poisoning, if you get million times the dose that's in the vaccine, like any substance is a potential toxin. Water is a toxin. If you take enough water, if you drink enough water, you could go into seizures and even die. But the amount of mercury that's in vaccines couldn't possibly be associated with anything as complex a developmental disease as autism. And in fact, we even know if you get a million times more the amount of mercury that's in vaccines through mercury poisoning, it does cause a syndrome, but it's a syndrome that looks nothing like autism. And we know this because of what happened in the 1950s in Japan, in a part of Japan called Minamata Bay. There was massive environmental exposure to mercury. Kids were exposed to massive quantities, and what happened was they got limb deformities, they had muscle weakness, they had tremor, they had abnormal eye movements. They had growth retardation, severe limb deformities, nothing like what we see in autism. So the idea that mercury could be associated with autism, to me, doesn't make any sense from what we know about organic mercury exposure.
And Neil, if I could add to that.
Go ahead, David Amaral.
Dealing directly with thimerosal, the case doesn't look very strong. So the call is correct that most drug companies eliminated thimerosal in pediatric vaccines starting in 2001. And it's estimated that around the end of 2002, most of those vaccines that contained thimerosal were off the shelf. And then if you look at the statistics coming out of the California Department of Developmental Services, which regulates services for families that have children with autism in California, it turns out that the first quarter of 2007, the quarter we just finished, had 886 new children and families with autism brought into the system. That's the second highest quarter in history, in the 38-year history of the Department of Developmental Services. And the first highest quarter was in 2006. And what you need to know is that children are typically diagnosed with autism around 3 years of age. So those kids who were getting, for the most part, vaccines, doesn't apply to the flu vaccine, but for the most part, all the pediatric vaccines after 2002 were not receiving thimerosal, yet the rates of autism in California are still increasing.
Thanks for the call, Sally, and we wish you,
thank you so much.
And you and your son the best of luck.
Oh, thank you.
All right, bye-bye. Let's turn now to, if I can hit the right button again, Keith. Keith is with us from Kansas City.
Hello.
Hi,
thank
Keith.
You for having my call.
Sure.
My son is in this court currently.
The vaccine
and,
court.
I just wanted to kind of go through what happened briefly with what happened with my son. He was at 15 months old. He was just putting two words together, and he was just being able to run. He met all of his milestones. he went in for a doctor, a well visit, and he got 4 shots that day. He passed out in my arms. The doctor told us, oh, that's normal. They do that. We took him home. We went home. He slept all night. He wouldn't wake up. That was not him. About 11 o'clock, we called the doctor and said, he's not coming, waking up. They said, is he breathing? Yes. Is he having seizures? I expected shaking tremors like a grand mal or a petite mal, but he wasn't. But he wouldn't come to. They said, oh, they do that. Just wait it out, and he'll come to. Well, about 24 hours later, he finally got up, but he would no longer look at us. All he did was stare at the lights on the ceiling fan, and his eyes were dilated. We called back to the doctor's office and told him this, and all they said was, oh, they do this. He started having problems with his speech. He started losing his speech within that week. We go back to the doctors, and as soon as we say the word vaccine, we are just totally put aside and ignored. And he digressed into autism, and we didn't know anything about vaccines or anything about thimerosal, MMR, anything like that. And we kept not getting straight answers. And I finally went to a client of mine who was a retired staff person from Children's Mercy in Kansas City, and I told him what happened. And he said, well, I think they give too many kids too many shots too early before their immune systems are developed. Mm-hmm. And you need to go see these kinds of doctors. Well, he pulled some strings for me to get into the system early and get our child diagnosed. What I find really strange is you guys have people that are pretty one-sided on this show, and that does not surprise me for NPR, because NPR is underwritten by a lot of these companies that face trial courts if this gets out into trial court, like Johnson & Johnson. So I'm really surprised that you're even talking about this, but I would really wish you would point out the other side, such as the epidemiological studies, which are drastically flawed and denied in court, in this court process, the raw data to replicate it. It's not science if you can't replicate it.
Keith, I think you deserve 2 responses, one from me, which is that we consulted the best experts we could find, and they told us there is no scientific evidence of any connection.
David Kirby.
Keith, we let you talk. Would you please let me talk? The best people we contacted, our reporters who cover this, told us there is no credible scientific evidence of a connection between vaccines and autism. We book on the basis of our... I let you talk. Please let me talk. And we're going to ask for a reply to your point. And Dr. Hotez, you have a child who yourself who is autistic. Does what Keith has been talking about, does this sound familiar?
It sounds really familiar, and I think, you know, it's very important that the parents of autistic kids get their voice heard. We can go into more detail about why I think that there are a number of explanations why vaccines can sometimes have toxic reactions but are unrelated to autism. But I think it gets back to what Gardner Harris said, is this fervor that so many parents have that need to have this, feel this link between autism and vaccines.
What happened to my son had happened to what happened to Keith's son, I would be very suspicious of vaccines as well.
Yeah, vaccines can cause, rarely they can cause encephalopathies, like 1 in a million cases, mm-hmm. but they don't cause autism. They can have a number of cause allergic reactions. They can cause rarely toxic encephalopathies. But we're talking incredibly unusual and highly rare events. And the overwhelming likelihood is that presumably this child is now autistic, that autism started when the baby was in the womb. And so because we know this, because we've seen the brains of kids coming out early in life, that there are established structural changes, including rapid head growth that begins shortly after birth, that includes an absence of a type of neuronal cell called a Purkinje cell. These changes are launched in utero, but it's also very important to point out that there are different forms of autism. One of them is called Rett syndrome, in which there's a very characteristic drop off in milestones that begins around 15 months of age. Whether or not this child got vaccines is totally irrelevant.
Let me turn to David Amaral and putting Keith's point to you again. If this had happened, of course, people tend to think of cause and effect. Do you understand why people don't believe sometimes what the evidence tells you?
Absolutely. And I'm, you know, incredibly sympathetic with Keith and with other parents who've gone through this. Let me just explain, first of all, that among the different types of autism, there are two major categories. There's one that is the type that Peter's talking about that has an early onset. So essentially at the get-go, and as soon as you can detect the behavior of a child, it looks like there's something abnormal. They don't answer their name. They don't make eye contact. And this can actually be detected nowadays as early as 6 to 8 months. But then there's a second group of kids with autism, and these are called regressive autism. And the characteristic of regressive autism is that for the first year, or perhaps even the first 18 months of life, the children are hitting normal developmental milestones. They gain language. They have what looks like essentially normal social interactions. And then something happens between 12 and 24 months of life where they regress. They lose language, they lose social ability, and they regress into sort of classical autism. And the bottom line, though, is that if you look at when kids are getting their vaccinations, they're getting their vaccinations between birth and 18 months of life. This is the time point when we see most of the regressive autism. So there's an incredible temporal correlation between when children are getting vaccinations and when we see these cases of regressive autism. And nowadays, the estimate is that regressive autism may account for as much as 25 to 40% of all cases of autism. But of course, as you've pointed out, Neil, and as we know in science, correlation does not necessarily mean causation. So I think that it's perfectly understandable, particularly a decade ago when parents were struggling to make some sense of their children's autism, trying to find something. I think it's a testimony to the parents that they actually went back and said, well, what are in these vaccines? You know, what could be toxic beyond the antigen that's trying to make the kid healthy? Well, there's things like thimerosal, ethyl mercury. We know ethyl mercury is a neurotoxin. Why was that ever in a vaccine? And there's other things that may be contributors to potential pathology. The bigger issue, I think, and is that we have to stay open-minded to what causes autism. I think everybody would agree that there are going to be multiple causes. At the Mind Institute here at UC Davis, we have a Center for Children's Environmental Health that's looking at a variety of environmental potential contributions to autism. And we think, actually, that the issue of vaccines may be masking the much more important issue that a subset of kids with autism have a dysregulated immune system. Maybe the fact that some responded poorly to the vaccines is just showing us that we have to pay more attention to immune function in autism. And I suspect, and the scientific evidence is now showing, that that in a sizable proportion of kids with autism, the immune system is dysregulated and may not be able to deal with environmental toxins as well.
Keith, if you're still there, I know that you're not going to be satisfied with those answers and that our sympathy will be cold comfort.
I was gonna say, Boyd Haley, Dr. Thomas Brubaker, and Jill James are experts that you can talk to. They provide a genetic model for where some autism may come from, and that's what 4,800 people think in court, is that some of the autism is from their vaccine.
Keith, thanks very much for the call. Good luck.
Okay.
Bye-bye. We're talking about vaccines and autism. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Jeff on the line. Jeff with us from Boston.
Hi there. Very timely for my wife and I, as we have our first child at home. He's 1 month old, and we are nervous about vaccinating him. Mm-hmm. My question is where does the funding for these studies come from? I can see that it would not be in the best interest of the U.S. government or whoever, doctors, to have people stop vaccinating. I mean, if the findings ever came out that there was a link, we could have a serious problem on our hands.
So, Dr. Hotez, who funds these studies?
As far as I know, most of the funds, a lot of the studies were actually done in Europe, in Denmark, in Sweden, and Great Britain. And I'd have to look at the sources of funding. My guess would be, in the case of the UK, it would be the MRC, the Medical Research Council, mm-hmm. or the Swedish or
Danish.
But
certainly not these drug companies, not the makers, and not the U.S. government.
That's correct.
All right.
I mean, in terms of getting to your specific answer about should you have your child vaccinated, I mean, come on. I mean, we're talking about the leading killers of children in the world. And the reason I say that, I do a lot of work in developing countries. I'm interested in making vaccines for neglected tropical diseases. I work in places where you see children gasping for air from whooping cough, dying acutely from measles, getting horrible deaths from tetanus. The only reason those kids in developing countries get those diseases and we don't is we vaccinate our kids, and those kids don't have access to vaccines.
Yeah, and we're going to vaccinate him.
And you should feel good about it, and it's the best thing you could do for your child.
Jeff, thanks very much for the call.
Nerve-wracking.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I'd like to thank our guests. Obviously, there are many more questions that we could get to, and we will return to this as the trial proceeds in vaccination court. David Amaral, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, Neil.
Professor of Medical Psychiatry at the University of California, Davis's Mind Institute. We'd also like to thank Dr. Peter Hotez of the Sabin Vaccine Institute with us here in Washington, D.C. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about respect. It's NPR News.